You're listening to the Tupton Children Podcast.
So let's begin with our motivation. And remember that we are under the influence of our karma, that whatever we are today is a result of our actions in the past. We are a conditioned phenomena, always changing under the influence of causes and conditions, never remaining the same. And at the same time that we're changing, as new karma ripens, we are also creating karma that will influence what we become in future lives. So experiencing the results of previous karma, creating the causes for future events, they're all occurring together in this one lifetime. Sometimes we get so wound up in the results we're experiencing from our previous karma that we forget that every moment we're creating the causes for what we're to become in the future. So it actually works much better for us to accept the results of the causes we've created and then use them to create good causes for the future. So doing this is what they call learning from our mistakes, also learning from our good qualities, and taking responsibility for our life and going ahead in a positive way. So while we're doing this, we have to realize that all other living beings are under the influence of their karma as well. Wanting to be happy, not wanting to suffer, but they, like us, not always having a choice about what we experience because our previous causes, our previous conditioning is running the show right now. And so for that reason, to have an attitude not of judgment of others, but of kindness and compassion. And then to develop the bodhicitta motivation, seeking full awakening so we can liberate both ourselves and others from our polluted karma and from the afflictions and especially the ignorance that caused them. So we were on 364, right? Yeah. Okay, so Nagarjuna has been telling us about pain and pleasure, their dependent nature, their emptiness of inherent existence, and how there's no genuine pleasure in samsara. There's just lesser degrees of pain. And so really trying to tweak our samsara to make it perfect so that we're totally comfortable and everything's happening the way we want it to happen is useless, even though we keep doing it. Yeah. But to really get to the point of seeing that it's useless. Okay, so in verse 364, you know, he's been talking about emptiness the last few verses and how emptiness overcomes ignorance and also craving. Yeah, craving being the eighth of the 12 links of dependent arising, the thing that really ripens at the time of death, and together with clinging fertilizes the karmic seed and projects us into the next lifetime. Okay, so 364, Nagarjuna says, but who does this seeing? Okay, so, you know, who does this seeing of emptiness? Yeah. Conventionally, the mind is said to do so, but without mental factors, there is no mind. Since the mind is unreal, we do not accept that two moments of mind can be simultaneous. Okay? So here, you know, Nagarjuna is showing that not only external objects, you know, such as the table and the computer, lack inherent existence, but also the mind that perceives emptiness lacks inherent existence as well. So our old friend Joe Blow says, well, who sees this reality? Who sees emptiness? And Nagarjuna says, well, conventionally, the mind does. Okay, so while the object emptiness is an ultimate truth, the mind that realizes emptiness is a conventional truth. It's called a concordant ultimate because it's the mind that realizes the ultimate truth. But actually, it is not an ultimate truth because only emptiness, the nature of reality, is an ultimate truth. Okay, so the Arya's meditative equipoise on emptiness, to which all dualistic appearances have dissolved. Okay? That meditative equipoise arises and ceases. It's a conditioned phenomena. It's not conditioned by karma, because it sees reality. But it is conditioned, it is impermanent, and impermanent things are conventionalities. They're not ultimate truths. But also what's interesting in here is it says, you know, the mind is what sees emptiness, but without mental factors, there is no mind. Okay? So you never have a primary mind, I don't care what you're perceiving, a primary mind that's totally separate from mental factors. Yeah, there's always the five omnipresent mental factors. Do you remember what they are?
Attention, intention,
contact,
discrimination,
What else do we have? Feeling. Okay. Contact, feeling. Yeah, there must be discrimination too. Yeah. Venerable Seva? Right? Okay. So all of those come along with every cognition. And you can't have a primary consciousness separated from them. And you can't have a cognition that lacks all of those. So it's interesting because when we talk about the mind and the mental factors, We think of all of them as being inherently existent. Here's the mind. One, two, three, four, five. Mental factors. They're all out there waiting for an object to come along and be connected, and the sense faculty to be activated. And then all these pieces just go boom. Yeah, that's the way we think of it, doesn't it? Yeah, but that's not the way they are. You can't talk of a consciousness without an object and without mental factors and without a faculty. You can't talk of any of those other things without talking about the rest of them, because they're all mutually dependent. Okay? They're identified in relationship to each other. They don't exist as independent entities on their own. Okay, so if one of them isn't there, then the whole lot isn't there. So this mind that realizes emptiness, it does not perceive itself. It only perceives emptiness. So they always talk about how the mind cannot perceive itself. In the same way, what is it? An acrobat cannot ride on his own shoulders, and a knife can't cut itself. Okay? So there always has to be an object involved there. So only emptiness appears to this mind if the wisdom realizing emptiness could observe itself, then it would be inherently existent, because it would exist in and of itself without depending on other things. Okay? But it doesn't inherently exist, and so that's why it says two moments of mind cannot be simultaneous, because that wisdom realizing emptiness does not perceive itself. Okay, it perceives only emptiness. When you come out of meditative equipoise on emptiness, then there's a conventional reliable cognizer that certifies the existence of emptiness. Okay. Okay, now we're going to go into a very interesting section here. Kenzer Rinpoche talks about this. So there's some sutra, I wasn't able to track down the reference, that says that not seeing anything at all is seeing the meaning of emptiness. Yeah. Or there's another sutra that says not seeing is the highest seeing. Okay, so there's a correct and an incorrect way to understand these kind of quotations. So when the sutra says that not seeing anything at all is the meaning of realizing of emptiness, okay, that means that when we examine how an object exists by looking for the designated object in the basis of designation, okay, not finding that designated object is not finding true existence. Okay? And so, in other words, when we look for a truly existent object, we can't find anything. Yeah. So, but some people interpret the meaning of the sutra that, you know, that not seeing anything at all is the meaning of emptiness, to mean that when you realize emptiness, you see total nothingness, because nothing whatsoever exists. Okay, so that is not a correct understanding of the sutra. Yeah, because if you think like that, then your next thought is going to be, well, why exert so much energy to realize emptiness if nothing exists? And why try and understand dependent arising if nothing exists? Okay, so then you get all tangled up and you fall to the extreme of nihilism. So similarly, when the sutra says that not seeing is the highest seeing, it doesn't mean that not seeing anything at all is the highest seeing. It means not seeing inherent existence is the highest seeing. The highest seeing being seeing emptiness. So what you're in the sutra saying is what you're not seeing is inherent existence, and what you are seeing that is the highest seeing is emptiness. Okay? So if you were to fill out the sutra, it would say, not seeing inherent existence is the highest seeing of seeing, because you see emptiness. Okay? That's how you would fill it out. Okay? So, again, you know, misunderstanding that and saying not seeing is the highest seeing, then again, people fall to nihilism and say, you know, nothing whatsoever exists. When you realize that nothing exists, then that's the best thing to realize, which, again, leads you down that slippery slope after that head cow that's going down the cliff into the jungle. Okay. So, you know, it's also kind of deceptive, okay? Because if you misunderstand it, then you think, okay, when the Arya's wisdom, realizing of meditative voice, realizes emptiness, it doesn't see any phenomena, so nothing exists, neither conventional truths nor ultimate truths. In that case, the mind that's realizing emptiness also doesn't exist. And emptiness itself doesn't exist. Okay, so then, if that mind realizing emptiness doesn't exist, how's it going to realize emptiness? And how's it going to realize nothingness at all? Okay? And similarly, you know, if the mind itself didn't exist, then when you eliminate all the obscurations, then the mind itself would be eliminated. Okay? This is kind of veering towards some of the beliefs in the Pali tradition. Not everybody, but some. Remember we were talking about this before? That, you know, they say that when you attain nirvana and have eliminated all the afflictive obscurations, that the continuity of consciousness ceases. Yeah? And we were saying, our tradition was saying that that doesn't make any sense, because then who has realized nirvana? Because if there's no consciousness, you can't posit a person who's realizing nirvana. Okay? So then you have nirvana, but you have no person. When you have a person, you have no nirvana. So how can you tell somebody it's good to realize nirvana? Okay. Okay, so then that leads us to verse 365. It says, having properly realized that in this way, beings are actually unreal, having no basis for rebirth or any appropriation of new aggregates, one who attains nirvana like a fire, whose causes have ceased. Okay, so when we have correctly realized that sentient beings are unreal, that is, that they're empty of inherent existence, then we've realized that the conceived object and the apprehend, you know, the conceived object of the self-grasping mind doesn't exist. And we also understand that the mind that grasps sentient beings and other phenomena as inherently existent is an erroneous mind. And so if we meditate on this repeatedly over time, then it erases the afflictions from our mind and purifies the mind and leads to the true cessations. Okay? So these meditative equipoises are true paths. They lead to the true cessations. And in that way, the craving that leads to renewed existence in samsara, that craving ceases. And so the clinging ceases, so the karma doesn't get fertilized, it doesn't ripen. And so that is like a fire that has no fuel. And so cyclic existence comes to an end because its cause, the true grasping, has been eliminated and the person attains liberation. So according to, are people clear about that, how that works? Okay, so when we realize emptiness directly, we realize that the conceived object of the self-grasping doesn't exist. We also realize that the self-grasping mind is an erroneous mind. So then when we keep meditating on emptiness with direct non-conceptual realization, it counteracts all the late, you know, the seeds of the afflictions, especially the seeds of ignorance in our mind stream. That ignorance ceases. When the ignorance ceases, the craving which depended upon it ceases. When that craving ceases, you know, then clinging, the ninth link, and renewed, you know, doesn't. Craving and clinging don't come up, so then there's nothing that fertilizes the polluted karma that causes rebirth, and so then rebirth doesn't exist. So it's like a fire that goes out because there's no fuel. Yeah, which is probably why there's the confusion in the fundamental vehicle. Because saying the fuel goes out, so then the fire goes out, then they're thinking, okay, there's no ignorance, so the mind stream discontinues. Whereas we would say there's nothing that can stop the continuity of mind. You know, clarity and cognizance continue one moment causing the next, and there's no counterforce or antidote that can cease that process. So then we say, you know, the consciousness continues even after the person attains nirvana, even after the person attains Buddhahood. And so even the Buddha has five aggregates. Although I've been doing some reading, and apparently people interpret Chandrakirti as saying otherwise, but I haven't gotten to that part of the book yet. But some people are saying that Chandrakirti, you know, I would want to see the citations, you know, that he said that at full awakening the consciousness ceases. Yeah, that's of course not what the Tibetans say, but there's many different interpretations. So I want to see why, how these people say that and how the Tibetans refute it, and so on. Okay, 365. We just did that one. Okay, so also according to the Prasangika system, the fundamental vehicle arhats also realize the emptiness of true existence. So we've been studying tenets, and we can see that in the lower tenets, they say you can attain liberation simply by realizing the absence of a self-sufficient, substantially existent person. Yeah, which is a self of persons. They don't say that you have to realize the selflessness of phenomena. Okay, but the Prasangikas do say that, and their assertion of the selflessness of phenomena differs from the Chittamatrans. Yeah, and so they cite many definitive sutras to show that, and they also say, unlike the lower tenet systems, that all the fundamental vehicle arhats, so those in the here and solitary realizer vehicles, that they realize the emptiness of inherent existence, just like the bodhisattvas do. Okay, so this is a unique tenet of the Prasangikas. And to substantiate that claim, they quote a ball of foam sutra, which, if I remember correctly, is in the Connected Discourses. I found the actual citation. I don't have it marked down here, but it's in there. And the citation reads, "Forms are like balls of foam, feelings like water bubbles, discriminations like a mirage, volitional factors like a plantain tree, and consciousnesses like illusions. So explain the kingsmen of the sun." Okay, so by this kind of passage appearing in a fundamental vehicle sutra, then the sharp faculty disciples understand that it's teaching emptiness, and they meditate on it and can realize emptiness directly through this way. Okay? So when it says forms are like balls of foam, what are balls of foam? What's inside a ball of foam? Nothing. It looks like there's something, but there's nothing inside. Okay, so all the forms we see are like that. Yeah. Feelings, all of our feelings of happiness and unhappiness, pleasure and pain, when we grasp very strongly onto our feelings and we react very strongly to them, they're like water bubbles. Yeah, so again, the water bubbles, what's inside a water bubble? Nothing. How long do water bubbles last? Not very. Okay. Discriminations are like a mirage. And you look in the distance, the combination of the sun and the sand and everything, then you see a mirage. You see water where there is none. So all of our discriminations that identify this object and that object, the other thing, they're all like a mirage. Totally false appearance. Volitional factors are like a plantain tree. Now, they usually say the trunk of a plantain tree is hollow. I looked on Wikipedia, and I learned that a plantain tree does not have a trunk. Okay, actually, it's growing up, and what looks like a trunk is the outer sheaves, that just keep collecting as it grows more and more sheaves, and so it's empty in the center, but it's not actually a trunk. Okay, so... So volitional factors like a plantain trunk, well, there isn't one. But what it means is the trunk is empty. There's an appearance of something, but there's no trunk. There's nothing there. And consciousnesses are like illusions. Yeah, they're like, we take our consciousnesses so seriously, but they're really like the ghost sitting next to you on the haunted house ride in Disneyland. Yeah? That's what they're like. Okay? So if you are very sharp when you read something like this, yeah, you can come to see that actually there's no essence in anything, and that essencelessness is emptiness. Okay. So then Job Loeb says, okay, this advice is for the hearers and solitary realizers, but it also shows that the bodhisattvas meditate on the non-true existence of phenomena. And the prasangika say, yes, the bodhisattvas do meditate on the non-true existence of phenomena, but the Buddha gave advice separately to bodhisattvas about meditation on this, because in the scripture it says just like that, in order for the bodhisattvas to attain liberation, they also have to realize emptiness. And so by saying also, it indicates that in addition to the hearers and solitary realizers, they realize emptiness. So they all realize the same emptiness, but the bodhisattvas realize emptiness through many different reasonings, coming at it in many, many different ways, as we saw when we were studying the 400. Yeah, one way after another, every way you look, yeah, true existence is getting negated. And then 366, bodhisattvas, having also had this realization, become firmly intent upon awakening. It is due to just their compassion that they continue to take rebirth until awakening. So bodhisattvas have the same realization of emptiness, okay? But why do they not simply attain liberation? Why do they go on to attain full awakening? It's by the power of their compassion, okay? So when you read Chandrakirti's homage downstairs, that's where it's coming from, okay? So, when the hearers and solitary realizers meditate on emptiness, it's supported by their renunciation of samsara, and it's also supported by their merit. Okay, but they collect much less merit than the bodhisattvas do. And their merit is not called the collection of merit, as in the collection of merit, the collection of wisdom. Because to be the collection of merit, it has to be supported by bodhicitta. And the hearers and solitary realizers don't have that. So in other words, the creation of merit, not all creation of merit is the collection of merit. Okay? So the bodhisattvas, when they train in wisdom, it's supported by compassion and bodhicitta, also by their unshakable resolve, okay, and their dedication prayers. So, you know, the method side of the path for the bodhisattvas is different than for the hearer and solitary realizer, arhats. And so even though they realize the same emptiness, it's the method side of the path that really propels them to go on to full awakening. Okay? But they all realize the same subtle emptiness. So again, this is different than the lower schools who say that they have different realizations in terms of the ultimate truth. Okay, so then Job Loeb, our friend, says, you say the bodhisattvas realize emptiness and through that eliminate attachment, anger, and ignorance that cause rebirth in cyclic existence. And if they no longer have attachment, anger, and ignorance, they no longer have the cause of cyclic existence in their mind stream. So how can you say that bodhisattvas remain in cyclic existence to benefit sentient beings? Okay, that's what Job Loeb's saying. So the answer to that is that, first of all, the lower level bodhisattvas, the ones on the path of accumulation and path of preparation, they haven't realized emptiness directly and non-conceptually yet, and so they do take rebirth in samsara under the influence of afflictions and karma. Yeah. They're not really in samsara, and they're not really free from samsara. They're on their way there, but they basically are still in samsara because they are taking rebirth. They don't have choice about their rebirth. But, of course, they've created so much merit that after the fortitude peak stage of path of preparation, they're no longer reborn in the lower realms. Okay. Then, once you hit the path of seeing, those bodhisattvas, by and large, are not reborn under the, well, they're not reborn under the force of afflictions and polluted karma like our ordinary beings, but under the force of their compassion, unshakable resolve, and their unpolluted karma. And so a lot of those bodhisattvas have choice, well, they all have choice about where they're going to be reborn, but many of them also, instead of taking a rebirth with a flesh and blood body, they manifest a mental body. Yeah. And in that way are able to really benefit sentient beings much more. So even though we have the expression that says that these Arya Bodhisattvas take rebirth in samsara, in fact, yeah, these are the ones that aren't, they haven't totally ceased samsara because they still have, on the path of seeing, they still have the seeds of the afflictions in their mind, okay, as well as the latencies, so they haven't ceased their samsara, but they're not taking rebirth under the influence of ignorance and polluted karma. Okay, so even though we say they take rebirth in samsara, actually, it's not in the ordinary way that they do once they're on path of seeing, path of meditation, and then, of course, path of no more learning. Okay? So while these, the Arya Bodhisattvas that have a mental body, they may appear as ordinary beings, and they look like they're experiencing birth, aging, sickness, and death, but they don't experience suffering in the way ordinary beings do. So this is quite important. But then we may say, well, if they don't experience suffering, why are they showing why does it look like they're experiencing suffering if they aren't? Well, because they have to appear like us in order to relate to us. If they appeared, like we talked the other time, if all the Buddhas appeared and did all their magical powers, everybody would just stand around in awe of them and worship them and throw money at them, and nobody would practice. Yeah. So the Buddha has to, you know, and the high bodhisattvas have to appear as ordinary beings to get us to relate to them properly and take the teachings seriously and not just get into, you know, this kind of worship that some people get into. Okay. Then, 367. Okay. Here we're going to be moving into, we're starting to move into a new section in which Nagarjuna talks about the Mahayana, the universal vehicle, and explains why the universal vehicle teachings are the teachings of the Buddha, because there's some people who say that they aren't. So he goes into quite a number of verses saying that they are. Okay, So before I get into that, you know, because His Holiness talks a lot about this, and he says, you know, because Nagarjuna was born in South India, and so, you know, he had access probably to all of the suttas that became the Pali canon that went to Sri Lanka, and, you know, and then also the Mahayana sutras. And it, you know, Nagarjuna wasn't just some kind of, you know, nincompoop. He was somebody who was quite learned, yeah. And he checked things out very rigorously, you know. What did the Buddha really say? What did the Buddha really mean? And so His Holiness says, you know, if Nagarjuna had found that the Mahayana teachings were not the teachings of the Buddha, he would have said so very clearly, and he would not have quoted them. Yeah, he would not have written about them, and he would have said, you know, they're baloney. But he didn't say that. Yeah, he was very learned. He investigated all of this, and his conclusion was that the Mahayana sutras were the teachings of the Buddha. His Holiness himself hypothesizes that perhaps at the time when the Buddha taught, you know, since most of the teachings were orally and they were passed down orally, yeah, because this is one of the refutations scholars give for saying that the Mahayana teachings are not the teachings of the Buddha. They say that the way they're written, or the way they are, their content, is for something suitable to be written down. Because you see with the Pali Suttas, there's a lot of repetition, there's a lot of refrains that come again and again that make those suttas very easy to memorize. Yeah. Whereas in the Mahayana sutras, they're not as easy to memorize because you don't have those stop passages. You don't have all the repetitions in the sutras. You have a lot of sutras written in prose, yeah, or spoken in prose. So His Holiness hypothesizes that at the time the Buddha lived, when he spoke those sutras, there were a few, you know, because there was some writing at that time. It wasn't widespread, but there was some people who knew how to write, that those people wrote the Mahayana sutras down and then passed them down very privately, very quietly, in written form, possibly in oral form also. And why they didn't make them public is because it wasn't suitable for most of the people who were alive at that time, whereas the suttas in the Pali canon were much more suitable for the disposition of those people. Okay, so that's His Holiness's hypothesis here. Okay, but it's still a disputed thing, yeah? Very disputed. You have people in the following the fundamental vehicle who's saying that the Mahayana Sutras are not the word of the Buddha. You also have many scholars saying that as well. Okay, and then you have all the Mahayanas saying that they are the word of the Buddha. Okay, but it's quite interesting because the scholars, the academic scholars, I mean here, who are not necessarily Buddhists, you know, when they first started studying Buddhism, their first exposure was to Buddhism in Sri Lanka, you know, with Colonel Olcott. And so that's really what they knew from the beginning. And since in Sri Lanka they said, you know, the Pali Canon are the actual suttas of the Buddha, not anything else, then Western scholars believed that and they did their research from that perspective. Now what's happening is they're realizing that there was a lot more going on in India and in Sri Lanka than they initially thought when and they just read the Fundamental Vehicle Sutras. Because now it's coming out that actually you had Mahayana and Tantrayana texts in Sri Lanka. You know, that there was a big dispute over what to follow. The king told the monks in the Jetavana and the Abhayagiri monasteries that they either had to disrobe or become monks in the Mahavihara tradition. He gave them those two choices and that was it. So they became monks of the Mahavihara tradition, which is the one that is later became the Orthodox Theravada tradition, whereas the Abhayagiri and the Jetavana traditions had a lot of Mahayana influence in them. And they're also finding a lot of new texts now that are showing that maybe the time that they originally thought the Buddha lived may have been a little bit later, and the new texts that they're finding have been earlier than what they've ever found before, so that the distance between the Buddha's life and the Mahayana Sutras, that distance, or the Mahayana Sutras becoming popular in society, that time period is narrowing as they're finding other scriptures. So it's quite interesting to, and the academic scholars, I find it interesting reading what they write, but I don't always believe everything. Because years ago when I started reading academic histories of Buddhism, they all said that their common theory at that time was that the Mahayana was a lay movement that came because the monastics were getting too withdrawn from society. The lay people felt left out of society, left out of Buddhism. So the lay people started the Mahayana tradition, in which you have bodhisattvas who are not monastics. And that the scholars were also saying that the cult of the stupa was very involved in the origin of the Mahayana, with people, worshipping stupas, and then that stupa worship somehow relating to the appearance of the Mahayana scriptures. They aren't saying that now. That's what they used to say years ago when I read. They don't say that now. Now they're seeing that actually the Mahayana grew up in the same communities where fundamental vehicle teachings were being practiced. And that the monks lived together from both things, and that it was just a different motivation. And then a few different sutras that they followed, but they all lived together. They did the posada and so forth together. Yeah. And they're saying that it actually kind of started within the monastic community and then, of course, spread outwards to the lay community. So there's many, many different ideas. And in fact, I remember asking Samdang Rinpoche one time about it, and he said, actually, we don't know what happened. Yeah? Because everybody rewrites history in their own way. In Sri Lanka, they really rewrote the history of Buddhism in the island once they got rid of the Jetavana and Abhayagiri monastics. Yeah, they kind of rewrote it. And we don't know, because, there were the 18 schools initially in India. There's so many different versions of the 18 schools. Nobody agrees on what the 18 were. And we also only have 3 of them that are extant. We don't really know what happened to the rest of them, if they blended in with other of the 18 schools, or if they were destroyed by warfare or famine. We actually know very little about Buddhist history in India. Because everything that was written down, I mean, the most information we get is from statues and inscriptions, because those still exist, and some of the paintings, you know, still exist, but especially the carvings and the inscriptions, you know. But in terms of written sutras, everything was written on papyrus, and it all decayed. It's gone. We don't really know. Yeah. So everybody has their own idea of history, and having your own idea of history is not limited to ancient India and Indian Buddhists. It is very alive and well, even in our country, as they're trying to rewrite the history of the U.S. in the textbooks now, especially our favorite state, Texas. Yeah, it wants to rewrite the history to show that it was originally a Christian nation.
It's already been rewritten.
Yeah, but basically the victor writes the history. And then history gets rewritten as time goes on, and more rewritten, and yeah. So we never really know what happened. Even one day after something happened, everybody has a different memory of what happened. Everybody noticed different details. Everybody's going to tell you a different story. Okay, so we're on 367, right? So the Tathagata taught the Bodhisattva's collections in the collections of sutras in the universe, it could mean collections of merit and wisdom also. Yeah, it must mean collection of merit and wisdom. The Tathagata taught the Bodhisattva's collections in the universal vehicle, but it is derided by those who are confused and antagonistic. Okay, so in the universal vehicle, the Buddha extensively explained the importance of Bodhisattva's training in the two collections of merit and wisdom. But some people hearing this were, because of their own confusion and their ignorance, they were filled with a lot of doubt whether this was really the Buddha's words, and they became antagonistic because it was scary for some people to hear the ideas expressed in the universal vehicle, and as a result they disparaged it and put it down. Because anything we disagree with, we disparage. Anything that doesn't agree with our opinions is wrong and bad. Isn't it? You know? And like I often say, first people decide what they believe, then they find sutra quotations to support it. Yeah? And then anybody who disagrees with your idea, well, they're wrong and they're bad, and you better speak out against them. Okay, so so there's many, you know, there's some people who hold incorrect ideas about the universal vehicle. That's how we're translating Mahayana here. Okay. And so thinking that it's not from the Buddha's words. Others get a little bit nervous because the Bodhisattva vehicle is in the fundamental, it's in the Pali tradition. Okay. This Bodhisattva vehicle is explained there, but it's extensively explained in the universal vehicle sutras. And some people, when they read the Bodhisattva's deeds, they get a little bit like, you know, you mean I have to stay in samsara for three countless great eons, and that's after I generate bodhicitta? That I'm not even starting my three countless great eons now? And they get nervous and they go, that's too much, you know. That's too much, can't do that. Or they hear, you know, talks of how the bodhisattvas give up their body, give up their family, and people say, you know, I can't give up my body. It's ridiculous, you know, giving up your family, giving up the people you care about the most. We can't do that. Yeah. We were saying today that because of some of our kitties not getting along, we may have to relocate a kitty. And all of a sudden, everybody's like, not the kitty I like. You know, we're not giving away my kitties. So, I mean, yeah, so this whole thing of giving away your family, you know, or giving away your body, you know, but we're quite possessive of our kitties. We're not giving away any of our kitties. Our kitties are perfect, kind of, until they pee all over the place. But they'll get better. Okay, so, okay, so in the verses that are coming now, that Nagarjuna is going to clarify some of these misconceptions that make people either anxious or antagonistic. Okay, so he says, 368, 369, those who deride the universal vehicle either cannot distinguish good qualities from faults, or they mistake good qualities for faults, or else they despise good qualities. So what harms others are faults. What helps them are good qualities. Recognizing this, it is said that those who deride the universal vehicle dislike good qualities. Now, why would you say that those who dislike the Mahayana who deride the Mahayana dislike good qualities? Okay. So actually, here, Nagarjuna is presenting different reasons why people wouldn't like the Mahayana. First, they can't distinguish good qualities from faults. So they do not see that working for the welfare of all sentient beings is a good quality. Yeah. They see it as a shortcoming. It's unrealistic. It's impractical. What are you talking about? Working for the benefit and of all sentient beings and leading them to awakening. You know, that's impossible to do. So you're all living in la-la land, thinking like that. Okay? So they say, you know, that's bad quality. They can't discriminate what's a good quality and what's a bad quality. The second fault is they mistake good qualities for faults. So they see relinquishing working for your own welfare and striving for others' welfare as a fault. Okay. So relinquishing your own welfare and working for the welfare of others is a good quality, isn't it? But they're confusing it and they're saying it's a fault. Why should you relinquish working for your own welfare? If you don't get liberated, what good are you going to be to anybody? Yeah, you're just going to revolve in samsara again and again and never get out. So, you know, relinquishing working for your own welfare is a big drawback. Okay? Yeah, I mean, I've heard people say these things. Then third, they have some kind of spontaneous dislike for the qualities of the universal vehicle. So this could be because they lack karmic imprints from previous lives that would make them receptive to the Mahayana. Yeah, or maybe in previous lives they had, you know, they had a lot of these wrong ideas about it, strongly imprinted into their mind, and so that continues in this life. Okay, so some people know that harming others and helping them, harming others is a fault, and helping them is a good quality. Yeah? So fundamental vehicle practitioners, they know that. You know, they practice ethical conduct. Harming others is a fault. Benefiting them is something good. Yeah? And still, they criticize the Mahayana teachings. Okay? So a lot of this happens because the fundamental vehicle contains some of these same points about the bodhisattva practice that the Mahayana does. But the Mahayana explains it extensively and explains the bodhisattva path in its entirety. In the fundamental vehicle, it's explained much more concisely, and it also says that not everybody will follow the bodhisattva path, that they see arhatship as, they don't see much difference between arhatship and full awakening in the fundamental vehicle path. Yeah, because they say the Buddha was an arhat. When we do our prayers, we say he's a foe destroyer, we say he's an arhat. So they say basically the Buddha and the other arhats have the same realization. The difference is that the Buddha is a wheel-turning Buddha, meaning that in a dark age where the Buddha Dharma did not exist, he manifested on earth or in somewhere in the universe and gave the teachings. And so a Buddha is, they only speak about wheel-turning Buddhas. They don't speak about other Buddhas. Yeah? So then, you know, the basic difference between wheel-turning Buddha and an arhat is that the Buddha gives the teachings in a time when things are dark, and arhats don't. Yeah. Yeah. So they don't see a big difference between their realizations and what obscurations they have eliminated. Yeah. So the whole differentiation into afflictive obscurations and cognitive obscurations, this is something made in the Mahayana Sutras. Although they do talk of some kind of latencies in the fundamental vehicle sutras. Quite interesting, you know. There's little things sprinkled in, and then, you know, Mahayana's taken that and said, oh, that means, and develops it. Okay. So love and compassion are explained in the fundamental vehicle scriptures, but they're not explained fully like they are in the Mahayana. And this is a big misconception that followers of the Tibetan tradition have, by and large, not everybody. They think that the Theravada, current Theravada, and fundamental vehicle in general, that they don't meditate on love and compassion at all. And I remember one time, this was in 1993, so it was a while ago, but His Holiness was giving some teachings in Arizona, and some people were asked to give, Westerners and some Tibetans were asked to give talks in the evening. And so Sharon Salzberg was giving a talk about metta. It might have been actually about the four immeasurables, all four of them, or it might have been just about metta. And one of my very good friends, who is a very learned Buddhist scholar, he went to the talk, and the next day he said to me, my goodness, they talk about the four immeasurables and love and compassion. He was like shocked. Yeah? And this is part of the ignorance, you know, that the different traditions have about each other, is they have preconceptions that have been passed down in generations, from one generation to the next, that are completely not true. If you look in the Visuddhimagga, there's a whole section on how to deal with anger. You know, it comes in Buddhaghosa's explanation of the immeasurable compassion and immeasurable love. So a huge description of how to deal with anger. Yeah? It's a lot like Shantideva. A whole lot like Shantideva. Yeah. And I don't think people recognize that. Yeah? I don't think that, and this is one of the reasons why I was so for writing Buddhist and one teaching Menon traditions, is because the fundamental vehicle people don't realize that, you know, look, here's a broader explanation of exactly the same points in the Mahayana. The Mahayana didn't invent new things. Yeah, they took things like that and just elaborated on them. And the Mahayana people don't realize that, hey, these same things are spoken about in the Pali scriptures. And so don't think that those people lack love and compassion. That's simply not true. So, yeah, quite interesting. I mean, just sentient beings being sentient beings, isn't it? We develop conceptions and we believe them and we pass them on to others.
But there are distinctions in those presentations, right?
Pardon me?
There are distinctions in those presentations.
There are distinctions, but they're so related, you know, that when I mean, really, if you read Buddhaghosa's thing about how to deal with anger, Shantideva was definitely in touch with that. Okay. Shantideva went on, he elaborated things more. But the point is that the Mahayana is based on the fundamental vehicle. It's not a separate thing that's unrelated to the Pali tradition, okay? And many people see it, you know, especially in the West. What do they talk about? The three vehicles, yeah? Vipassana, Zen, and Tibetan Buddhism, like they're three different vehicles. Completely wrong. First of all, those aren't the three vehicles. Second of all, you know, Tantrayana is a form of Mahayana. It's not something separate from Mahayana. And Mahayana is founded on the fundamental vehicle. I mean, this is why His Holiness does not use the term Hinayana. He uses the term fundamental vehicle. Yeah. And I think Hinayana should be banished from, you know, because certainly the people that the Mahayana call Hinayana, those people don't call themselves Hinayana. Hinayana means lower vehicle. It's derogatory. If we're going to have harmony in Buddhist traditions, we have to respect each other. Yeah.
Well, I heard the translators at the Pythonis teaching talk about Hinayana. The translator.
Yeah.
The translator
in what?
In the His Holiness teaching.
Yeah.
They talk about Hinayana.
He may say Hinayana.
Yeah.
But I've been to teachings where His Holiness talks about fundamental vehicle. His Holiness, if he's reading a text, the text may say Hinayana. So His Holiness is reading the text, so the translator may say that. But His Holiness really would prefer that to be phased out.
Yeah. I had a discussion with a monk in Singapore, and then he said, well, it's in the sutra, so it's okay to use it.
Well, it's in the Mahayana sutras. Yeah. But so you could say, well, it's in the Mahayana sutras, it's okay to use the terms Hinayana. My question is, do you want to have religious harmony between all the Buddhist traditions? Do Buddhist traditions want to come together and work together as a force for good in this world? Or do some of Buddhist traditions want to put their hands on their hips and say, we're the great ones and you're the inferior ones? That's my question to those people. Yeah. I don't don't care about the terminology in the sutra. Yeah. Because what do you think is going to please the Buddha more? What do you think is the Buddha's intention?
Harmony.
Harmony, isn't it?
But even if you say, change those terms, there's still a disparity in the two explanations of what most people can accomplish.
Yes, but then that's because both the fundamental vehicle and the both the Pali tradition and the Sanskrit tradition, both of them talk about three vehicles: hearer vehicle, solitary realizer vehicle, bodhisattva vehicle. And both of them say that people can accomplish these three vehicles. They have different criteria about them. Like I was saying, you know, in the Pali tradition, they say only certain people become wheel-turning Buddhas. In the Mahayana, they say everybody can become a Buddha. But the thing is, based on what is said in the fundamental vehicle sutras, you have the outgrowth, extensive explanations in the Mahayana sutras. Yeah. So we shouldn't see them as you know, two different things, and as one better than the next. Because, I mean, if His Holiness, what does He always talk about? He says it's so good there's many different religions. You know, He talks about Christianity and all the theistic religions and how good it is that people there believe in God, because, you know, in their scriptures it says God tells you not to kill and to be an ethical person and to forgive and to have love and kindness and compassion. And that's great, and that benefits those people. And those people, you know, have that disposition. If there weren't that teaching, those people would be completely lost. So if we're working for the benefit of sentient beings, we have to appreciate that those teachings exist, even though on a philosophical level, we can completely negate the existence of God. You know, on a philosophical level, we tear it to bits. But is it good that there's a teaching like that other people believe? You bet. Yeah. So, of course, you know, so then we have to respect other traditions. So if we're going to respect theistic traditions, then what are we going to do? Not respect other Buddhist traditions because there's differences in philosophy? That's ridiculous, isn't it? Yeah, we have to respect other Buddhist traditions. And we have to respect the people that practice them, because those teachings fit those people. And it's not a one-size-fit-all thing where we can squeeze everybody into one philosophical belief because it's the best one and the right one. Because every philosophical system says it's the best one and the right one. I mean, we study the tenet systems. What did we do? The Vaibhasikas say, those middle way people are nihilists. They don't have the middle way. They're nihilists. We're the middle way. So everybody says they're the middle way. Everybody says the other people are nihilists and absolutists. Now, we follow one system and we agree with the reasoning behind that system. You know, and we think that is really true. But does that mean that we put other people down because they don't believe that? Or because the reasonings that we give don't make sense to them at this particular moment in their spiritual development? No. Okay. When the Buddha was talking about how Buddhism wasn't going to be destroyed from the outside, it's going to be destroyed from the inside. And creating disharmony is the, you know, it says it right there in our posada, doesn't it? It's right there in the posada. Yeah, that harmony in the Sangha is the surest cause for awakening. I think it's quite important. It's really very important. Otherwise, what are we doing? We're becoming, you know, Buddhist bigots. Aren't we? You know, kind of my favorite politician, you know, manifesting, you know, these people are wrong and we're excluding them and they're bad and they're all, you know. Yeah. Questions, comments? Yes.
When you said that the bodhisattvas don't experience suffering, how do we understand when we talk about bodhisattvas feeling sad, pretending being suffering?
Okay.
And also like when they talk about, you know, Avalokiteshvara feeling so sad that he, you know, his splits into a thousand pieces.
Okay. Okay. So first of all, it's not that bodhisattvas don't experience suffering. The lower level bodhisattvas do, okay? Then, as far as the higher level bodhisattvas, you know, like, you know, the story of Tenrezig or Kuan Yin, looking at all the hell realms that keep getting filled up again and again, and feeling so sad and shedding the tears, and the tears becoming, you know, Tara.
And breaking into a thousand.
Yeah, yeah, feeling so desperate about it, his head broke. No, yeah, his head broke into 11, or it wasn't his arm. Anyway.
He fell apart.
He fell apart. Yeah, he fell apart. So I think it's, my theory is, okay, they feel sad, but sadness is not an affliction. When we feel sad, there's usually an affliction combined with our sadness. I'm sad because I didn't want to get what I wanted. Okay, so there's anger, there's self-centeredness, whatever. When bodhisattvas feel sad, it's because what they cherish so much is sentient beings, and sentient beings are suffering. Yeah, and that makes them sad, but there's no anger involved with it. There's no desperation, there's no disillusionment, there's no, I'm giving up on the whole thing.
Do they suffer?
I don't think they suffer, no. They feel sad. Then they're not jumping for joy. Yeah. But they also realize that the suffering can cease. Okay? So they're not depressed over seeing sentient beings suffering, because they see that the suffering has causes and the causes can be ceased. So I wouldn't say that the bodhisattvas suffer because of seeing sentient beings suffering, because that would make it sound like, you know, that is going into personal distress, which it's not, because they're completely focused on other living beings. Okay?
Well, you're saying that the bodhisattva vehicle is in the Pali, so for the practitioners who rely on the Pali, mm-hmm. how do they relate to the bodhisattva vehicle like Theravada practitioners?
Oh, there's Dhammapala, 6th century Pali sage, wrote a whole text called the Treatise on the Paramis. Paramis means paramitas. And he explained the whole Bodhisattva path. Yeah, according to the fundamental vehicle view. They have 10 paramis. Some of them have the same names as our paramitas. Some of them have different names, but the meanings of, in both sets of 10, the meanings are found in the other set, in the other traditions. Yeah. And Bhikkhu Bodhi told me that there's one section in it, I don't know which section in Dhammapala's text, that comes straight out of Asanga's Bodhisattva book.
No.
Yeah.
Asanga did things though.
Yeah.
People, it's not unusual to take whole sections of
Text. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah, I mean, people didn't mind plagiarizing because it was the Buddha's word.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But it proves a point about His Holiness's take on the traditions being side by side. And,
And it's quite interesting seeing, you know, how the ten paramis that they practice and how the path is laid out. Okay.
Mm-hmm. I want to ask a question about the earlier part in teaching about the mind can't perceive itself. Mm-hmm. And is it that when you say the wisdom realizing emptiness, if it could perceive itself, because that what that wisdom would be perceiving, if inherent existence existed, it would be perceiving it. Mm-hmm. So if it was perceiving itself, that would have to be inherently existent. I don't kind of follow the whole.
Yeah, because if the mind perceived itself, the mind would be some self-enclosed entity. One moment of mind would be a self-enclosed entity that wouldn't depend on other things. Yeah, so for that reason. Okay.
Mm-hmm. Someone asks, is consciousness considered to be only a conditioned phenomenon? And if so, how can consciousness be present in the state of nirvana?
Okay, so is consciousness always a conditioned phenomena? Yes. Okay. How can it be present in the state of nirvana? Because nirvana is the true cessations that are possessed by that consciousness. In other words, the ultimate nature of that awakened consciousness is emptiness, is emptiness, and true cessations are a form of emptiness. Okay? Yeah, that person's thinking, okay, consciousness is here, nirvana's here, this one's permanent, this one's impermanent, they can't go together. But it's the whole idea behind the two truths, being one nature, but different, different isolates. So it's a bit difficult to understand. We'll get into it in Buddhism, One Teacher, Many Traditions. Okay, okay, so where are we?
370.
Okay.
May the spiritual teachers who lead me on the sacred path, and all spiritual friends who practice it have long life. May I pacify completely all outer and inner hindrances. Grant such inspiration, I pray. May the lives of the be stable, and their virtuous actions spread in the 10 directions. May the light of Losam's teachings dispelling the darkness, of the beings in the three worlds always increase.
To this merit,
may we soon attain the awakened state of Guru Buddha, that we may be able to liberate all sentient beings from their suffering. May the precious Bodhi mind, not yet born, arise and grow. May the born have no decline, but increase forevermore. In the snowy mountain pure land, you're the source of good and happiness. Powerful Tenzin Gyatso Chenrezi, may you stay until samsara ends.
May the deeds of explaining and practicing the Dharma,
done by groups supporting the teachings and their upholders, who spread the view of dependent arising and nonviolent actions in the 10 directions, and especially at Shravasti Abbey in the West Floor.